I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the land of the midnight sun, the climate is the choreographer of life. The first snow signal caribou migration. The first hard freeze sends the bears out on the ice hunting seals. And the first welcome warmth of the short summer is a cue for the birds to return. The people who live there know it is a matter of survival. For the Inupiat of Alaska, the Inuvialuit and the Inuit of Canada's high Arctic, the reliance on and the predictability of climate tells the people when to travel, when to sleep, to hunt, and to eat. But for decades, these northerners have watched that predictability erode, and a tiny number of scientists has been charting what we now call global warming. George Devokey is an ornithologist who annually travels to a tiny island in the sea north of Barrow, Alaska, a place so far north that the magnetic needle in an airplane compass spins in hopeless confusion. It's there he studies the habits of a bird, the black guillemot. It was there last summer where the writer Darcy Frey found Devokey for a feature he wrote in the New York Times magazine called Watching the World Melt Away. Now, Connection listeners, the people who inhabit the North have been telling us about their climate change for some time. Is the truth to be found in this area where Aboriginal understanding and the mechanics of modern science intersect? What does the North have to tell us about the ways the whole world is changing? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, check out our website for more information on this and as a place to write in your ideas. We're at theconnection.org. A little later on this hour, we'll be joined by an Inuit leader who's been outspoken on these issues. But first, we're going to Barrow, Alaska, to the ornithologist George Devokey, who's joining us from the NPR studio there. Hello, George.
Morning. Morning, Dick.
A little bit about the January weather in Barrow. How cold is it there?
It's actually a balmy 1 above 0 this morning. And with the wind chill, it's probably only around 20 below. So it isn't that bad. Certainly not as bad as it was last winter when I was up here.
Now, we shouldn't take that necessarily as a sign of global warming.
No. And this is actually, people are talking about just how warm it is here right now. This has been atypical for this year.
Now, you're normally doing your work on your island in the summertime. What are you doing up there in the winter, George?
Well, I'm up here now working with some students who came out to the island this summer, Barrow High School students, who helped me gather some data, and they are writing up this data for their science fair projects, hopefully going to the state science fair. And I've come up to help them get their posters together and analyze the data and things like that. And this is an important part, I think, of coming up to a place like Barrow and then going out in the field is staying in touch with people who live in town and certainly with students. And coming up here in winter is a way I can do that because when I'm up here in the summer, I'm out on the island the whole time.
We're joined from New York by the writer Darcy Frey. Hi, Darcy.
Good to be here. Thanks.
And you two know each other, so you can say hello.
Hello, George, from New York City.
Morning, Darcy. Yes, well, it isn't quite as bad as it was when you were here last year, but it's still kind of chilly.
Darcy, to the people who live in places like Barrow and Iqaluit, the emptiness of the land or the loneliness of the horizon is just home to them. It's as unremarkable as a neighbor's picket fence. But for your New York eyes, going to a place like Barrow, or perhaps even going to George's Cooper Island out in the ocean, what was it like for you to see it for the first time?
Well, Cooper Island is quite a remarkable place. It's one of 6 barrier islands off the coast of Point Barrow. And it's basically nothing more than a 3-mile strip of sand and gravel. And it's frozen pretty much 9 months of the year right into the Arctic pack ice. It's both beautiful and bleak. If you stand on the north beach of Cooper Island, you look out on a plain of sea ice that stretches uninterrupted right to the North Pole. There isn't a tree for 200 miles around. When George and I first got to the island in early June, it was covered by snow and ice, and to stand on the island, you really couldn't tell whether you were standing on land or sea. It seemed as though we were basically standing right in the middle of the Arctic Ocean.
And George, you've made this your summer home for almost 30 years now, is that right?
That's correct.
Are you as enchanted by Cooper Island today as you were when you first saw it in the 1970s?
Yes, and I think that's probably an important point. I know that a frequent question I get from researchers and others is that how could I be putting in hard time on Cooper Island all these years just to gather data? Well, I have been gathering data, and certainly that's been a compelling reason to come back every year. But if I didn't find the place to be a very mystical place, I would not be coming back annually and spending as much time out there as I do.
Was it your discovery of the bird, the black guillemot, that made you decide to keep going back?
Yes, it was. The coastline close to Barrow doesn't have any of the classical cliffs or rocky outcroppings where seabirds typically breed. And in 1972, when I visited Cooper Island, and I was really surprised to find this large pile of boxes just strewn down the beach that had been left there in the 1950s, I was first just shocked at that they hadn't cleaned things up. But then when I found guillemots breeding in them, it was a very special thing because this meant that, one, that seabirds were breeding on this coast even though their typical habitat wasn't present. And then as soon as I started building nest sites and had guillemots occupy them, I realized, gee, I could build a seabird colony here, which is what I did over the next 15 years.
And allowed you to watch how their own habits are changing as well.
Yes. That's correct, and it is rather important that when I first got here, I didn't think about when the guillemot showed up in relation to when I showed up, and I just thought that they had certainly been probably in the area for quite some time, and even though the boxes were placed there or were left there in the mid-50s, that probably guillemots had been breeding in the Barrow area, but it was only when I started looking at snow records in the late 1990s and going back from 1945, which is when they started looking at snow here in Barrow, and realizing that the date of snow melt had been advancing since 1945, and it was only in the late 1960s when the period of the ground being snow free was big enough, which means it was 80 days. It was big enough to let guillemots breed successfully. So it was only then that I realized guillemots had been able to breed in the Barrow area only since the late 60s, and I was very lucky to get here in the early 70s and find them.
Now, George, you will know, and Darcy discovered, that when you are working on an island that far north at that time of year, you have what the Russians call white nights, what the North Americans call the midnight sun. So, Darcy, this guy's getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go and count birds, measure eggs, do stuff like that. What's it like for a reporter to spend 2.5 weeks with a scientist who's on such a wacky schedule?
Well, when George and I first got there, George announced to me that he was going to be reversing his sleep schedule. The guillemots are only on Cooper Island in the middle of the night, so George told me he, too, would be up in the middle of the night from about midnight until noon. That was going to be his work day. And then we would sleep in the afternoon from, say, 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. And for me, it became a very disorienting experience. I'd look at my watch. It would say 11:15. I couldn't tell whether it was a.m. or p.m. The sun was just making a constant sort of parabolic course all around the sky. And that, plus the wind and the cold and the rain and the fog, gave me what some Arctic scientists like to call Arctic brain fuzz, which is basically a sense of disorientation that you get from having your higher brain function sort of shut down as your body works to stay warm.
Now, George, I wish I had a better cliche than canary in a coal mine, but I don't. In fact, that's the little aha that you discovered, isn't it? That in studying the guillemot, that the behavior of this bird was telling you something about the change in the climate.
Right, and I have thought a great deal about the canary in the coal mine analogy. It is important to note that the canary doesn't really belong in the coal mine, and of course guillemots do belong in the Arctic, so that falls down there. But in terms of a species that is a monitor of a system that, if you look at that species, will then tell you something about the general health of that system. Certainly, the black guillemots have been able to do that, and I had no idea that when I started the study that there would be this period of rapid climate change for the next 2.5 decades that the guillemots would have to respond to, both in terms of the snow-free window opening, in terms of breeding, and then the pack ice pulling further offshore every year as the summers got warmer.
But did you go into this, George, with the idea that you would at some point find the evidence of climate change, global warming, or was there a moment when you went, whoa, what's happening?
No, No, I actually went into it with a very classical background in seabird biology and an interest in seabird biology. Seabirds as a group are very interesting because they have to breed on land and feed at sea, and most seabird biologists look at how they deal with that problem of having to incubate eggs and raise young on the shore, but yet fly some distance offshore to feed. And I was just looking at that throughout the late 1970s and early 1980s. And then in the late 1980s, when there was a rapid shift in the climate to a much warmer phase, I suddenly realized, wait a minute, what is going on here? Suddenly the population started dropping. The birds were breeding much earlier. Young were not doing as well in terms of their growth rates. And that kind of jumped up and hit me. And to be honest, if that hadn't happened, I probably would have, within a few years, said, okay, I have all the information that I can use on black guillemots right now and just kind of pack up the study, because I had all the information on feeding rates and survival and things like that I needed.
We'll be talking a little later this hour with the head of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference about the way that Aboriginal people in North America have been gathering this information in recent years. I want to go, before we do that, back to Darcy Frey, because, Darcy, your last book was about inner-city kids playing basketball. So you find yourself way up in the high Arctic, marooned for 2.5 weeks with George on this island, watching this little piece of science unfold and listening to him explain how the guillemots are indicators of this kind of change. And you're thinking all along that you've got to take this back to an editor at the New York Times Magazine and turn it into a story. Was it always going to be a story about global warming, or was that something of a discovery for you as well?
Well, I had started out the whole project wanting to write about climate change in the northern latitudes. Originally, my editors wanted to send me up to the North Pole, but we decided that there's nothing but a magnetic point and a big sheet of ice up there, and there really wouldn't be anything for me to do or anyone to talk to. So I relocated the story to northern Alaska. At that point, I hadn't met nor heard about George's work. And I went up to Barrow, where there are a whole group of scientists working on climate change, as well as a community of Inupiat who are very tied to climate changes. And I thought that if I spent time with the scientists and the folks in the community, I would get a firsthand view of what's really happening, because I think it's important to say that in the northern latitudes, climate change isn't something that's predicted for the future. It's something that's happening right now. But I went up in February of last year, and I spoke to a whole bunch of different scientists. But I did feel as though I didn't have a story that I could, as you say, bring back to my editors at the Times. I didn't have a way to ground the story. And it wasn't really until I met George on my second to last day up there, and he told me about his study, that I realized, well, this is a way of getting into the global warming debate in a very concrete way. The climate is an incredibly maddeningly abstract concept, even for the scientists who are working there. But what George has discovered with his birds is incredibly concrete and visual and visible to me when I was on the island.
Connection listeners, do you see climate change as an incredibly maddening abstract concept, or is the North, are the lessons that we can learn from the Arctic sort of indicators that we should be picking up on, paying attention to, and trying to read as interpreters of global warming and climate change? When we come back after our short break, we'll talk with Sheila Watt-Kluche, who's the Canadian branch president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, talking about the experience of the elders and the Aboriginal people. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on the topic as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join this program. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
It's 11:22.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. And Connection listeners, this hour we're talking about climate change, global warming, but we're also talking about that magical, imprecise area where science and Aboriginal knowledge intersect, and we can learn so much about the world around us. And we're interested in your thoughts, your experiences, if you have any, to share with us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guests are George Devokey. He's an ornithologist with the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska. He's on the line from Barrow. Darcy Frey is a freelance writer and author of Watching the World Melt Away, a feature on George's work, which was published in the January 6th issue of the New York Times Magazine. And we welcome to the program Sheila Watt-Kluche, who's Canadian branch president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. Hi, Sheila.
Good morning.
You're joining us from Iqaluit, once known as Frobisher Bay on Baffin Island. Can you see out a window from where you are right now?
Absolutely. Where I am, I have the view of the tundra and the ice and the mountains over here.
And you've had a chance to listen to the conversation to this point so far, Sheila. I'm interested to have you tell us a little bit about how the Aboriginal people of the North have or are making use of this kind of knowledge.
All right. Well, perhaps for the listeners who aren't too keenly aware of what our world is all about and who we are the Inuit, who are 150,000 in total in the entire world, who live in Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Siberia, part of Russia. And we are continuing to be a much connected to our land. We are a hunting and gathering people that remain very much guardians, in fact, of the environment, because we are on the land every single day. And any kind of minute changes that are happening on the land, we notice them right away immediately. And certainly we have been noticing these kinds of climate changes and environmental changes to our land and to our wildlife for quite some time now.
Give me an example of the sort of thing that somebody would tell you about, Sheila, or that one of the or that the elders would discuss.
Yes, well, the elders are now and have been discussing for some time now that the observations are including the melting of permafrost, the retreating of glaciers and ice sheets here on Baffin Island. There has been new species of birds seen here in the summer. There's been longer ice-free seasons in the Hudson's Bay, a lot shorter snowmobile travel seasons over the sea ice, and sometimes much more pronounced wind storms and strengthening of the sun. And in fact, some of our elders and hunters will joke about the need for Inuit now to use stronger sunscreen because it is suggesting that there's problems with the UVB radiation.
And when you,
so
when
there's
you,
a lot of things that are being observed here on the land.
And when you talk about the permafrost, for example, melting, you're talking about something melting that has never melted before in anybody's memory.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. That's right. And as a result of that, what is happening is there's some mudslides and mud that is being created where there has never been mud in the Arctic. So this is causing some problems in terms of the beach giving away. And there's been some, in fact, in Alaska, have needed to have some homes and some buildings moved back as a result of that. So this is quite serious that is happening already. We are living, as one of your speakers have already noted, we are living the effects of climate change today. This is not anything in the future at all.
And are the Inuit a little bit, as a result of this, a little bit dismissive of the scientists who are coming up and cataloging it, or are the Inuit saying, hey, we need to work together?
We're not dismissive at all. I've never known anyone to be dismissive. The only thing that we would want to do is to be in partnership with anyone who is coming up to do research and to work together, because the Arctic, of course, has now become the indicator for the world's health. And because we are hunting and gathering people who are on the land every single day, and we can be of great help to anybody who is coming up. So I think partnership is the key here to work with each other.
George Devokey, is this something that you are factoring into your science now?
Well, let me just mention with regard to the Native people and their support of researchers here, when my funding ran out for the first time in 1982, I came to Barrow hoping I could get out to Cooper Island. It was due to the warmth of the people up here and people who I had met when I had been funded from 1976 through 81. They then got me out to Cooper Island for the next 10 years, which was a very tough time to get out there in terms of a lack of funding, and frequently provided free rides in their boats, stopped by with food and things like that. So that my study couldn't have been done without the help of the native people in Barrow.
And what about the way that the Aboriginal knowledge is being gathered, is being put into databases, or is being documented, either, George, from your perspective, or Sheila?
Well, I actually think that is something, all those things she talked about, a shorter time you can go out on the ice every year, a longer and muddier summer season, all of those things, I have certainly seen them on the island, and to the extent that I make notes when the first boat shows up from Barrow and things like that, I have a record for the past 25 years or so. Those things are critical in terms of being able to look at climate change, because there are lots of villages where you don't have a sensor that is actually seeing what's going on with climate, but you do have people who are reacting to climate. And any way in which that data can be obtained and written down is obviously going to help in the long run.
Sheila, I remember meeting some hunters from Holman Island who were telling me about herds of caribou who were falling through the sea ice, which should have been strong enough to support them at that particular time of year, but wasn't, and thousands of them died. But I wasn't aware at that time of any way of any manner in which the information was being gathered in a usable way. Is that happening?
Yes, it is indeed. We've started the process here a little while ago. In 1999, there was a Winnipeg-based International Institute for Sustainable Development, which is the acronym IISD, and the Inuvialuit community of Sachs Harbour, in fact, in Northwest Territories on the Banks Island, initiated a project to record and illustrate some of these observations on climate change. And this video, in which Inuvialuit quietly but firmly, you know, firm authority pointed out what was happening in their environment, and this was shown to the delegates of the 2000 climate change negotiations in The Hague, although negotiations that nevertheless they did fail at that time. And we have also the NTI, as I was saying, the elders that had had a workshop here on Baffin Island to start to build a database on all of these. And as well as there was this very, I would say, an ambitious and very rigorously conducted book based on traditional ecological knowledge, a study of environmental change in northern Canada. And this book is called Voices from the Bay, which was published by the Canadian Arctic Resources Committee and the municipality of Sanikiluk, a small community on the Belcher Islands. And this study brought together 78 Inuit and Cree hunters and elders from 28 communities on the shores of Hudson and James Bay in a series of workshops over 3 years to describe, record, and verify these kinds of ecological changes in this quite huge bioregion, including and included but not limited to climate change or anything about the wildlife and so on. So yes, we are building this kind of data because as Inuit, we certainly, we feel that there are many things from afar, not only the climate change and global warming, but we've just come out of a huge negotiations process on the persistent organic pollutants, the contaminants that end up in our country food. So yes, we are being bombarded by global forces that which seemingly beyond our control. However, as Inuit, we don't want to depict ourselves as victims, nor do we feel we are, because we think that we have a way in which we can confront these issues globally, and we are starting to do so. And we're hoping that the effective way in which we have been dealing with the POPs issue, the contaminants issue, and came to participate in a global process of creating a United Nations convention that would eventually ban these persistent organic pollutants that end up in our country food, we're hoping to replicate that kind of a mode of operation in dealing with the climate change. Certainly we're not being naive in thinking that climate change will be perhaps as easy, because it is a huge issue, and many more players are in fact going to be part of this process.
Yes, indeed. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. To Wellesley, Bob, you're part of the connection. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I had heard that there was some recent research concerning the concentration of pollutants and demonstration that pollutants from, say, the populated areas of the world were being concentrated in the Arctic ecosystem. And I was wondering if your member panel could comment on that.
That was something that Sheila was, in fact, just talking about. Yeah.
Right.
George, from your bimonthly sojourn to Cooper's Island, are you seeing any of that or anything in the feathers of the birds, the weaknesses of the eggs?
Well, one of the benefits of studying something like the black guillemot is that it stays so close to barrow that it reacts to things at barrow. And there has been a change in mercury over the past 100 years, which I've been able to tell by looking at skins that were collected 100 years ago. There's been a change in mercury of 100% over that time due to the concentrations of mercury in the atmosphere. So yes, I mean, there is no source of mercury close to barrow. It's basically coming up from lower latitudes.
And Darcy Frey, you've been musing about turning the article that you wrote into something larger, perhaps even a book. I mean, how do you apply a writer's mind to this great array of choices when we're talking about, you know, everything from pollution to the south to climate change in the north and all the different people looking at it?
Well, I think one of the exciting things for me as a writer is that, as Sheila was pointing out, the Arctic is really, in many ways, it's the tail that wags the dog. What happens in the Arctic and its climate will be enormously influential on the global scale. Climatologists are in agreement that the climate will change first in the Arctic and change most significantly there, and change in a way that will have the biggest impacts on the climate globally.
But again, from the writer's perspective, you need to find the stories that draw people to it, the stories of people like George the scientist or the hunter who loses the herd or the mudslide that blocks the trail.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that I came across in talking to folks in the community at Barrow, and Sheila was mentioning this about permafrost, but it was another example of global warming made manifest. A lot of the folks in Barrow have ice cellars dug 20 feet down into the permafrost to store their whale and their seal meat. And for the first time in human memory, those ice cellars are beginning to leak water and become ineffective. I had some folks just take me down and show it to me, you know, so that I had an eyewitness view of it. And there are many things that have been happening on the northern coast of Alaska that sort of make this all very concrete. In Barrow, there's a twice annual whale hunt for bowhead whales. It's one of the high points of the season, both in the fall and in the spring. The spring hunt takes place out on the sea ice. Everyone is camped out anywhere between 3 and 5 miles offshore, right on the ice. And back in, I think it was 1998, there was there were about 100 folks out on the ice when suddenly that ice fractured into tiny bits, and no one knows for sure what the cause of that was. But it certainly came about because of thinner and thinner ice. And fortunately, Barrow has a very good search and rescue operation, and they had to come out onto the ice with helicopters and evacuate all the hunters, take their boats and their snowmobiles back to land. That's the kind of thing that you see when you travel up in northern Alaska. And that's why, I, as I was saying, it just feels as though climate is something that people are wrestling with right now.
Sheila, your neighbors, you can store fish, caribou on the back porch in a locked trunk in most of the winter months. Do you have to be more careful of that now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My own experience with this, the last couple of weeks, I store my food in my porch here, which is not a insulated porch. And at Christmas time, it went up to +3, and I had to scramble around trying to find room in my small freezer and putting it where it would remain frozen. So this is very much a reality. One thing
+3 for our listeners, I should point out, is above 30, above freezing. Folks in
Yes. 3 above to us is unheard of around Christmas time, and in fact we had rain, which is unheard of. We are very happy today that it's -31 so that the ice can continue to freeze. We are not happy the fact that we haven't had enough snow as yet. The rocks are still showing, and that is unheard of as well.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have your thoughts on the conversation we're having about the way that Aboriginal knowledge and science can work to bring together perhaps a clear clearer understanding of global warming, climate change, particularly when you look through the lens of the Arctic. 1-800-423-8255. To Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Cynthia's on the line. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
I've lived in Alaska for a number of years. I've been out here on the lower 48 now for about 20, but I spent time in the Arctic and went to school with some of the people from Barrow who were whalers and, you know, subsistence living type individuals. And I think that here in the lower 48 and around the world, we sometimes have our head in the sands about what is happening in other regions. We're so insulated regarding these types of issues. We just don't pay attention enough to how the climate is going to affect us and in generations to come.
Do you think it's because we end up being so selfish about what our own interpretations of climate are? It's whether or not we have to scrape the ice off the windshield of our car for, you know, 30 days or 50 days in a season, and that we're not paying the sort of attention, living in the South, Cynthia, to the type of information that is already available from your friends in Alaska, from people like the ones we have on the program today.
I actually think it's really even more than that. I think it's such an attitude that we have within ourselves that we're always safe, and I think September 11th showed us that we're not, but it takes such a tragedy, such a horrific type of situation to pull us out and make us face some types of reality that I think it's more a mentality than anything.
Well, there's a flip side to it as well. I often hear from people living in the lower 48, as you describe it, that if this is global warming weather for January, this is okay, you know, because it's not as cold. It's not as brutal weather as it might have been in years past.
That's true. I can remember I lived in the middle of the Brooks Mountain Range for a period of time, and 40 below zero, 50 below zero would be a normal day. And with the wind chill factor, you know, people down here don't really understand that type of living situation. And the things that you see in the Arctic, the migrations of the birds, even in the summertime, the tremendous amount of mosquitoes that breed up there, how all of this interacts with their world and their environment down here. I don't think there's enough education. I don't think that our government has put enough information out and has really given it enough consideration. They're looking at what's happening around the world, and if they don't pay attention to what's happening globally with the environment, there's going to be something catastrophic that's going to happen, and they're going to be playing catch-up again.
Cynthia, thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Connection listeners, are we paying attention? That's Cynthia's question. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to bring us your ideas about the way that we can look for the guidance of the North and the indicators we should be paying attention to in regard to global warming. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on NPR. You're listening to The Connection. It's National Public Radio. We're talking about northern climate change and whether or not the lessons from the high Arctic are even being listened to in the lower 48. 1-800-423-8255 brings you into the conversation. My guests are George Devoke. He's ornithologist with the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska. Darcy Frey is a freelance writer and wrote a piece this past weekend in the New York Times Magazine called Watching the World Melt Away, featuring the work of George Devoke. And joining us from Iqaluit on Baffin Island, Sheila Watt-Kluche, who's the Canadian branch president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. Joining us now from Potsdam, New York, is Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. It just seems like it's such an important thing. I was wondering how the United States government, for example, or worldwide governments, how they are concerned about this situation. They seem to be so concerned about other things that go on in the world, and this seems to be at least should be at the forefront of their concerns. Is there a considerable financial thing that the United States or governments provide for scientists? I know there is a professor that I'm acquainted with that has done studies on a grant basis to study the ice pack in the area for submarine travel. Is there things like that, that go on a regular basis, I was wondering.
Darcy, the impression that I get of the work that you did on this is that there's not a lot of government money behind people like George.
Yeah, I think that's right. From the research that I did, it seemed as though most of the money that goes to polar research ends up down in Antarctica at the McMurdo Research Station. And it made what George and some of the other scientists based up in Barrow, what they're doing, seem all the more heroic to me. It's a small but very hardy group of individuals who are working out of an organization called the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium. And they get some money from the National Science Foundation. But I think that your caller is right. It's Arctic science is pretty unfunded. It's tough. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, the administration in the last year has shown very little regard for the climate change issue. You know, the Kyoto protocols that almost every industrialized country signed a few months ago, the big absent party was the United States, which, of course, emits more carbon dioxide into the air than any other industrialized country.
George Devoki, you have a lot of time to think about things like this up on your island, and I'm curious to know if you find it frustrating that at a time when this research is indicating pretty strong evidence that global warming is a reality, that people continue to buy their gas-guzzling SUVs and that governments continue to sort of brush aside the notion of getting behind in any organized way the type of research that you're doing.
Yes, it is very frustrating to have the problems that I have basically in terms of talking to Barrow or getting to and from the island, knowing what is possible in the Antarctic when NSF really puts money behind something. I should mention that the government has realized that Barrow will be a focus for climate change research and has talked about building a science facility up here. I've been to two meetings where they've talked about the nuts and bolts of how much space would be needed and what sort of gear would be needed, and that may come through, and that would change things greatly. As Darcy knows, when you get to Barrow, there is nothing like the McMurdo Station that you can go to, and there are other scientists, and there is a support staff. There is the Barrow Arctic Science Consortium that's getting by with a skeleton crew. There is the North Slope Borough Wildlife Management Department that has helped me greatly over the years. But again, it's almost like basically relying on the kindness of strangers.
All right, Steve, thanks for your call to Cambridge. George, you're on The Connection. Hi, George.
How do? Excuse me. I have one data point and a question. My data point is I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the crocuses are already beginning to pop up, which is the earliest that I've ever seen them do that in over 20 years. My question is whether the people of the Arctic have started talking to the people of the Pacific. For instance,
I mean the North Pacific?
That the island of Tuvalu has already started evacuating people from that island because the seas are rising.
That's Tuvalu in the South Pacific.
Yeah.
Sheila.
Yes, well, we do work very globally here in the Arctic with many, many players of the world. We have to. We can't work in isolation. So certainly we do understand that the Arctic and the, I believe what you're talking about is the southern Pacific states, island states, are now the world's indicator for this issue of climate change. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that there is an American, actually, the few Americans may know this, but the Americans, the United States is in fact leading an 8-nation state circumpolar impact assessment on climate change under what we call the Arctic Council, which includes the 8 Arctic countries of Canada, USA, Russia, Iceland, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, Greenland, which was created in 1996. And Bob Correll, an American, Washington-based, is heading this, actually. And this report, called the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment Report, will be deliverable to the foreign affairs ministers of the Arctic Council in 2004. And we're still hopeful that the United States will turn around on the Kyoto Protocol. But I think very few Americans do know that this is indeed happening. But, you know, it is well known that northern indigenous peoples are likely to pay an incredibly disproportionate heavy price culturally, socially, environmentally, and economically as a result of this climate change. And but nevertheless, the federal governments have yet to really seriously engage us on some of these very compelling issues that mean a lot to us in the Arctic.
All right, George from Cambridge, thank you for your call to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the connection. Hi.
Good morning. I'm just checking in to say that one doesn't really need to go to the Arctic to be an observer in a local environment. I've lived in this western suburb of Boston all my life, and 60 years ago, for example, we would very rarely, if ever, see the spectacular red bird, the cardinal, in our feeders in the backyard, or mm-hmm. the tufted titmouse, or the mockingbird, for that matter. They're regular species here now. And you just have to say, what's going on here?
You know, I'm interested in that because you read in the newspaper that it's particularly cold in Florida, that it's particularly warm in this part of the western United States in this particular year. And yes, I notice the crocuses or the cherry blossoms. You're noticing the cardinals and the mockingbirds. George Devoki, when you look at it through the Arctic prism, is it in any way different from this?
Well, no, but what I think is critical about the Arctic prism, and certainly the place where I worked and where Sheila lives, is that there is water that goes from a solid to a liquid state at 32 degrees, and when you have a change in temperature that takes it from a solid to a liquid state, things change drastically. If you go further north, you're just going to get colder snow and colder ice. But if you're in an area where the temperatures are now getting above freezing at a time when they weren't above freezing, you will see drastic annual changes. And I think that's why the Arctic, and that's certainly why the black guillemot is such a critical species, because it's tied to snow and ice habitats. And snow and ice can react directly to climate change, whereas various habitats at lower latitudes would take some time to have the plant structures change and things like that.
Okay, but Lincoln, Massachusetts, it might not be that unusual for people there to see a mild winter. I guess what I'm trying to understand is when you see those sorts of fluctuations in the Arctic, is that any more of an indication of longer-term change, or could those also just be fluctuations?
Well, it is clear since 1945, when good snow records started being taken at Barrow, that the date of snowmelt has advanced annually. It's also clear when you look at proxies such as tree ring width and other things throughout the Arctic that we're at the warmest temperature in the Arctic over the past 400 years, and this has been well documented in lots of places. So, if it's a fluctuation, it is a fluctuation at a century-long scale, and certainly the rate of change now is much faster than has typically been seen in climate changes in the past, and certainly gives one reason to think, okay, what is going on here? What is causing this?
1-800-423-8255. Jeff, thanks for your call to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Philip, hi, Philip.
Hi. My question is that recently I've read some articles about the subject, and some people are saying that are talking about the possibility of the Arctic ice cap actually breaking up, and I think that at least one article, someone was saying that it might be inevitable. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Sheila, I'll let you start on that. Is that ever discussed in Iqaluit?
No, we haven't been discussing some of those issues, but one thing that I will say is that when you mention about these issues down south being talked about, and you see the changes themselves happening in the south, definitely we realize that. But up here, I must say to you and stress the importance of when the snow doesn't freeze and when the snow doesn't fall and cover our land during these seasons, life almost stops. And I say this to people who don't know what it is like up here. The environment is our supermarket, and you can go get in your car and go to your store. We've got to get on a skidoo or a dog team or a boat to go out and get the food that we hunt and eat. And so it becomes a real issue of cultural survival up here for us. And I would just like to say, if I may, this quote from one of our elders that says, quote, "The world can tell us everything we want to know. The only problem for the world is that it doesn't have a voice. but the world's indicators are there. They are always talking to us, end quote. So I just wanted to stress the importance of what it is like for us up in the Arctic here in terms of these issues for us, whereas sometimes in the South, and I don't minimize the changes in the South, but sometimes, unless you're an avid skier, if you don't have snow, your life doesn't necessarily change, whereas up here, everything changes if the snow doesn't freeze and if the snow doesn't come down.
Darcy Frey, I want to ask you about the what Philip's bringing to the table, the idea of something dramatic like the breakup of the Arctic ice cap, because it reminds me, in a way, of what Cynthia said earlier in the program, that September 11th was this holy cow event, and that global warming, climate change, when we talk about variations in the snow melt, and not to diminish for half a second what Sheila's talking about, but without some kind of cataclysmic event like that, nobody is ever likely to take it as seriously as perhaps they should. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. One of your callers was talking about, as you're saying, that we're always waiting for some sort of catastrophe to motivate us to change. And I think that is one of the frustrating things about climatology. There are not necessarily signal events that you can point out to the public. And that was one of the reasons why I was actually drawn to George's research so much. His database now spans 27 years. In the field of climatology, you get 5- and 10-year data sets. So to have a 27-year data set, one of the things George has been able to do is see through the natural fluctuations that do occur in the Arctic climate, a kind of static that can confuse you if you're trying to figure out what a long-term trend is. There are decade-long cycles in the Arctic, upper atmospheric shifts that will warm the region one decade and cool the region the next. And George has been able to see through a lot of that static because of the sheer longevity of his study. So, and the other thing,
go ahead.
To talk about the polar ice cap melting, it's a drastic thing to think about, but it is not completely unheard of. There's some computer models that show that if there was a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that the summer sea ice would all melt by 2050. That is a drastic thing that could possibly happen. And if that were to happen, what would occur is that a lot of fresh, frigid water from the Arctic basin would start flooding into the North Atlantic. And one of the things that climatologists suspect may happen is that it would actually shut down the Gulf Stream and change climate patterns throughout the Northern Hemisphere. So that drastic scenario is not necessarily that far off.
I remember talking to a Canadian environmental scientist who said he'd been studying satellite photos and discovered that the ice in a fjord in northern Greenland had melted for the first time in 60 years. And that, to him, was the moment when he believed something dramatic was actually happening. I want to thank all my guests for taking time to be with us today. George Devokey is an ornithologist with the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska. Darcy Frey is a freelance writer, author of Watching the World Melt Away. It's in last weekend's issue of the New York Times Magazine. And Sheila Watt-Kluche is the Canadian branch president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. Thanks to all of you for being with me. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation. Go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. We will have links that you can use to find out more about this story. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.